Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 162 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'll be starting a new series for the pediatrics board exams. So this will be series one, and I'm going to be focused primarily on pediatric and metabolic disorders. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. So really, these are peds metabolic disorders. I would say that they're kind of complicated, kind of annoying to learn and all that, but unfortunately, they're kind of high yield to know for the peds boards. And the key thing you want to know about each of these disorders is you want to know the unique defining feature. Because again, many of these disorders, many of them cause vomiting, diarrhea, lethargy, blah, 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 blah. But if you know the unique defining features, then you can typically spot them pretty easily on exams. The only thing that makes these things annoying to learn is there's so many of them. But again, if you learn the unique defining feature, right, then things kind of begin to click for you. And the thing is, I will try to be very emphatic with defining features, and where possible, I'll try to explain like some light pathophysiology. I know people studying for the peds boards are not necessarily thinking in step one terms, because really many of these metabolic disorders, if you really go down and dig deep, many of them actually have like pathophys behind a lot of the presentations, but I won't go super in depth on those. If you're interested in any of those, you can, I guess, reach out to me. I can always try to explain, but yes, in general, you just want to learn the unique defining features. And the thing is, many of these pediatric metabolic disorders, right, most of them actually inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. So that's kind of a good thing. So you don't have to keep remembering this is inherited in this and that. No. You just need to remember, for the most part, they are inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. There are exceptions to this rule, right? And it probably makes sense to learn those exceptions. But trust me, it's better to learn the exceptions, and then you know that every other thing is autosomal recessive, right? So, for example, some of them are inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion. And one way I remember which one is which, especially those inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion, I remember that with the mnemonic HALO M, so H-A-L-O, and then a hyphen and M, right? So the H is for Hunter syndrome. And remember, there's this probably step one mnemonic you learned back in the day, that a Hunter marks an X spot, right? So X-linked recessive. And then the A stands for adrenal leukodystrophy. There is a kind of adrenal leukodystrophy that's inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion. And then the L stands for Leishmanian syndrome. That was actually discovered at my alma mater, Johns Hopkins. It was discovered by an attending and a medical student. It kind of makes you think how much you have to work harder to achieve in life. If a med student is already discovering stuff like this, right? But that was pretty impressive, I feel like. But yes, Leishmanian syndrome, right? A kid with self-mutilation and gout, right? Again, it will be in a boy. These disorders will likely be in boys because they are X-linked recessive, right? And then the O stands for ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. I remember OTC deficiency is classic in the urea cycle. Really, for the most part, every other urea cycle deficit that you need to know is inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, with the exception of ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. And then the M stands for Menkes disease, right? Remember, some people call it the kinky hair disease, where people have issues with copper metabolism. I'll talk about that later. And really, for the most part, some of these disorders, right? In fact, not necessarily some, but many of these disorders, they actually arise from just having enzyme defects, right? And the thing is, if an enzyme doesn't work, right, then bad stuff will accumulate. The thing is, if the stuff that accumulates is not terrible, right, then you probably, probably won't care much about it. Only problem is some of the stuff, many times in these diseases, the stuff that accumulates is typically really bad, right? So when it's actually accumulating in your bloodstream, doesn't do you too many good things, right? And especially when it accumulates in the brain or in the spinal cord or in the peripheral blood or in the liver or in the kidneys, right? Causes a lot of problems, right? And really, for the most part, it's amino acids and sugars that tend to accumulate. And I guess some weird metabolites are here and there, which again, we'll kind of talk about. And really, for the most part, these kids, when they're born, they're usually pretty fine. But once they get an exposure to something, you notice that, within, a couple of hours or days or months or years after birth, just weird things just start happening. They just become lethargic. They have hepatosplenomegaly and all that. That should kind of tip you off that you're dealing with some kind of a inborn error of metabolism, right? And really, for the most part, the way you detect these things is you do like a newborn screen, or like an expanded newborn screen. And obviously, right, if you want to treat these things, you try to give something that can, I guess, prevent can sort of break down these bad things that accumulate, or you can try to do some kind of dietary restriction that contains the bad thing you don't want to accumulate in these people, right? And many times as well, you also want to restrict these people's caloric deficiency, right? So you will probably want these kids that have these disorders to have like very limited periods of fasting, because when you fast, you begin to break down some of these nasty things that can then accumulate and then cause symptoms. So those are kind of like the big picture things you want to keep at the back of your mind with these metabolic disorders. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump to the first one, right? So what if they give you a question about a kid, that has like autism-like problems, has like seizures, has like albinism, so like skin hypopigmentation, has like a musty odor. What diagnosis are you thinking about? Well, I would hope you're thinking about a PKU, right? So PKU, phenylketonuria, right? It's like a deficiency in, and you can actually get it in one of two ways, right? So one way you can get it is by having a deficiency of an enzyme known as phenylalanine hydroxylase, right? So PAH. Remember, that's the enzyme that helps you convert phenylalanine to tyrosine. So typically, if you do a newborn screen for these people, you notice that they will have like very high levels of phenylalanine, and they will have like very low levels of tyrosine, right? The thing is, this is classically fine, like sometimes, because one thing I've noticed with these pediatric board questions is they occasionally give you like ethnicity. The ethnicity can usually actually guide you down a certain path, right? So for example, if they describe a like metabolic disease in like an Irish person, I probably want to think about a PKU, because it's pretty common in the Irish. And like I said, on newborn screen, you'll have elevated phenylalanine, you'll have low levels of tyrosine, because again, if PAH doesn't work, right, phenylalanine will build up and tyrosine will go down, because PAH converts phenylalanine to tyrosine. And then typically when people do these newborn screens, they also tend to check like levels of, activity of a tetrahydrobiopterin, so like BH4. Because there are actually some phenotypes of PKU that are associated with like problems with BH4. And I'll talk about that shortly in a second. And really, for the most part, right, these kids that have PKU, right, tyrosine, because the thing is, phenylalanine is an essential amino acid just in general, right? You get it from the diet, right? But when people have PKU, tyrosine then also becomes an essential amino acid, because they have no ability to make tyrosine because PAH is offline, right? And most times these kids are normal at birth, but if you don't treat it, by 2 months you'll have like irreversible neurological damage, right? So again, classic presentation on exams will be like a person that has like neuropsychiatric issues, right? From again, like from having like the low dopamine, because remember, if you go back to like your step one study, and I'm not saying to do that, but if you were to do that, you remember that phenylalanine, right, is converted to tyrosine, and then tyrosine can be converted to L-dopa by an enzyme I think known as like tyrosine hydroxylase, and then dopa is converted to like dopamine by like dopa decarboxylase. So if you have a deficiency of like something very upstream in that pathway, you have a lot of issues making dopamine, right? So these kids can have like neuropsych issues. They have issues like controlling their body temperature. They can have like albinism, because remember, tyrosine, remember phenylalanine gives rise to tyrosine, and then tyrosine can actually be used to make melanin, right? So if you have like that, those melanin, you have like low, if you have like problems again making tyrosine because PAH is down, then you won't be able to make a melanin, right? So they can have albinism. And then again, these kids tend to have like a musty odor. And again, for the most part, you want to treat it before at least they hit the age of 2 weeks. You want to treat it within the first few days of life, right? So that again, they don't have like permanent neurological damage. And these kids, right, hopefully remember that you want to hopefully avoid like diet soda, because remember, some of the stuff in diet soda, right, like some of them can be broken down ultimately to phenylalanine, right? And sometimes they can give you like these, like I don't think of them as nasty questions, but I think of them as like ingenious questions where they give you a child and they tell you that, oh, you know, this kid has like, you notice you do like a newborn screen, you notice that the kid has elevated levels of phenylalanine, so you adjust the kid's diet. But you notice that, man, this kid is still developing like sequelae of PKU. Under those circumstances, that should really make you think about like a BH4, like a tetrahydrobiopterin metabolism issue causing a PAH, I mean causing PKU. Because remember, phenylalanine hydroxylase uses tetrahydrobiopterin as a cofactor, right? So that's again one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So if you see PKU symptoms, like if you see PKU symptoms after like you've done the right thing, you've adjusted diets and everything, then think about BH4 deficient problems. Classically, it arises because a person has like a mutation in the enzyme known as a tetrahydrobiopterin reductase. So those people have trouble regenerating BH4, right? So if you have trouble regenerating BH4, you can have PKU style symptoms. And really, for the most part, the way you treat this PKU, right, is just modify these people's diet. You know, you want to give them a diet that's low in phenylalanine. Actually, there's formula, believe it, although it's very expensive, but there's formula that, you know, has like very low levels, almost no phenylalanine in it. And for the one where they have issues with like tetrahydrobiopterin metabolism, that they have those kinds of issues, you actually want to give them like the BH4. You want to give them BH4. The drug is crazy expensive. It's like $100,000 a year. Super expensive. Although I know there's some discussion in the works to make like a generic form, but I still suspect it's still be pretty expensive. And then these kids, right, they actually also need like a supplementation of L-DOPA, right? So you actually give them L-DOPA. Remember, L-DOPA is also used to treat Parkinson's. But yes, you do give them L-DOPA. Because again, the thing is, remember I said that tyrosine is converted to L-DOPA by tyrosine hydroxylase. Tyrosine hydroxylase actually uses BH4 as a cofactor. So if a person has like a BH4 metabolic issue, it's not just phenylalanine hydroxylase that will be all screwed up. Tyrosine hydroxylase will also be screwed up, right? So these people need a L-DOPA supplementation. And then they also need supplementation of something called a 5-hydroxytryptophan. Because again, remember that like the enzyme that makes 5-hydroxytryptophan from tryptophan actually does require BH4 as a cofactor as well. So those three enzymes that need BH4 as a cofactor, you do need to like essentially give things that would reverse the deficiencies you have with BH4 not being available. And one other classic thing they love to test on the pediatric board exam is, remember, if mom, right, let's say she's like a carrier of like whatever, like the PKU genotype, like she's a carrier, because remember, it's inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, right? One thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is she has to be careful, right, like with her diet. Because the thing is, if, for example, her kid, if she has like very high levels of a phenylalanine, that can also affect like the kid in utero, right? So those kids tend to be born with like small heads, so like they have like microcephaly, they have like intellectual disability, they can get all these congenital heart defects. So that's something you want to watch out for. Because the thing is, if you're taking like, basically like your kid sees like 1.5 times your serum phenylalanine concentration, right? So again, if the kid has a deficiency of phenylalanine hydroxylase, let's say mom has like, I don't know, like 100 of phenylalanine in her blood. That would be pretty high, if I'm not mistaken. The kid will see 150, right? So you want to be careful under those circumstances. And one thing I think I neglected to mention is, so I talked about the X-linked recessive disorders. I should also mention, right, there are some diseases that are inherited in a mitochondrial fashion, right? Those will be inherited from mom. That's something to keep in mind. For the most part, they tend to be like the classic two classic things you typically see on exams with those disorders. You'll talk about like lactic acidosis because the mitochondria doesn't work, right? So you cannot do this whole electron transport chain business. And then in addition to that, these kids tend to have like, you know, like stroke-like episodes, and they may have like, they may tell you that, oh, they do biopsy and you notice that you're seeing like ragged red fibers. That's like a classic presentation on the PEDS boards, classic presentation on the USMLE exams from back in the day. So again, these are all things that you just, again, want to keep in mind for these tests. Okay, so now, what if they give you a question about a kid, you know, that has like intellectual disability, has like a downward dislocation of the lens, And then they tell you that this kid has had like strokes and like I don't know, like let's say like coronary ischemia, and has all these like neuropsychiatric problems. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about homocystinuria, right? Homocystinuria. Remember homocystinuria, right? Can you know there are many things that can cause it. Typically, it can arise from like a, most commonly on exams, it arises from like a CBS deficiency. So just think like this TV station, CBS. CBS stands for cystathionine beta-synthase. So it arises from a CBS deficiency. Although there are many other things that can cause it, right? If you have like methionine synthase deficiency, sometimes they put that on exams as a MTHFR. So if you have like a methionine synthase deficiency, or if you have like a deficiency of like vitamin B6, so that's like pyridoxal phosphate, or vitamin B9, that's like folate, or vitamin B12, that's like a cobalamin deficiency, those can all cause a homocystinuria. And really, for the most part, you make the diagnosis by establishing that this person has like elevated levels of methionine and homocysteine, right? That's classically what you would observe in a person that has a that has the CBS deficiency as the cause of their homocystinuria. I guess, I mean, if you wanted to like look at other things, right? Like if, for example, a person had like an MTHFR deficiency as the cause of their homocystinuria, they will have elevated homocysteine, but their methionine will actually be low. Or if, for example, it was B12 causing their problem, they will have elevated homocysteine, and they will have like a methylmalonic acidemia, right? They will have like increased levels of methylmalonic acid. Those will tell you that okay, maybe this is more so B12 deficiency causing this person's problems than a CBS deficiency. And again, classic presentation, Marfanoid body habitus, right? Kind of like Marfans. But remember that people with Marfans tend to have normal intelligence versus people with homocystinuria that tend to have an intellectual disability. And then in Marfans, right? In Marfans, people tend to have like ectopia lentis, where the lens is dislocated upwards. But people that have homocystinuria, they tend to have like a downward dislocation of the lens. And then these people tend to have like, like a small but significantly increased risk of like venous thromboembolic disease, right? And again, the way you treat this for the most part, give them vitamin B6. You can, choose a diet low in methionine. You can also give them this supplement called like, it's like the levo form of like cysteine betaine. Basically, it's just when you give like the cysteine betaine supplement, it essentially promotes the conversion of homocysteine to methionine. Although there are also some issues with that drug because it can also like maybe cause like further elevations in homocysteine. So you typically only use it when you have like very low levels of homocysteine that you're trying to like decrease. And then obviously you also want to maybe give these people like a diet that's low in sulfur, because remember that methionine and homocysteine contain a lot of sulfhydryl groups, and it's those sulfhydryl groups that are super reactive and end up causing a lot of problems. Now, what if you get a question about a kid, that within the first few months of life like develops cirrhosis, and this kid has like a type 2 RTA, so like they tell you that oh, this kid has very low levels of phosphate in the blood, but very high levels of phosphate and all these amino acids in the urine. Or they give you a question about a kid that has like hepatocellular carcinoma, right? Or they tell you that, oh, this kid is Canadian, right? Like from Quebec, Canada. I hope I pronounced that right. Or they tell you that, oh, you have a kid that the urine smells like cabbage. If you see all those things, I would really hope you're thinking about a type 1 tyrosinemia, okay? Type 1 tyrosinemia. Really, for the most part, the thing that kind of causes many of the problems is you have a deficiency in an enzyme known as fumaryl acetoacetate hydroxylase. The way I just think of it is I just think of it as FAH, so fumaryl acetoacetate hydroxylase, right? And again, the presentation, you can't miss it on exams. It's pretty classic, like you have liver problems, like hepatocellular carcinoma in a kid, right? That's very unusual, right? So if you see like a kid with HCC or a kid with a type 2 RTA where they have like, like they have a Fanconi syndrome-like presentation where they have like hyperphosphaturia. I guess you can see hypophosphatemia, right? And they have like increased levels of like amino acids in the urine. Think about type 1 tyrosinemia. These kids, they'll have, like cirrhosis, like early cirrhosis, conjugated hyperbilirubinemia. They'll have like a coagulopathy because their livers don't work, right? So they have like clotting factor problems. They also tend to be hypoglycemic, right? Because again, gluconeogenesis doesn't work as well. And again, Canadians, urine smells like cabbage or like butter that's kind of gone bad. If you see that, think about type 1 tyrosinemia. I've noticed in general, these amino acid problems, they tend to present with like unusual smells, like PKU, musty odor, type 1 tyrosinemia, cabbage smell to the urine and stuff like that. So again, like I said, you have a deficiency in fumaryl acetoacetate hydroxylase. So there's this thing called fumaryl acetoacetate that will build up, right? The thing is, you want to actually know the two different names. I don't know what's wrong with me. So you actually want to know the two different names of this compound. So fumaryl acetoacetate is a name you may see on exams. But another name you may see on tests is something called a succinyl acetone. It's the same thing. Fumaryl acetoacetate is also known as a succinyl acetone. The thing is, this when you're breaking down a tyrosine, fumaryl acetoacetate, or you know what, I'll just call it succinyl acetone from now because it's kind of like easier to say that. But if you're breaking down tyrosine, there's like multiple steps. One of the final steps in the breakdown of tyrosine involves like the breakdown of something called succinyl acetone. Right. So the thing is, if you have a deficiency in the enzyme that breaks down succinyl acetone, which is again the FAH I mentioned earlier, then succinyl acetone will build up. And the thing is, it tends to build up like more so like in hepatocytes and in like proximal convoluted tubule cells. And the thing is, succinyl acetone, it's very reactive species. So because it's reactive, it can cause like DNA damage. And if cells have DNA damage, right, those cells undergo apoptosis, they die. Right. So that's why these people tend to have like liver problems and kidney problems, right? And again, right, if you're having like DNA damage, and let's say the cell progresses through that DNA damage and does not fix the DNA damage, right, that can also tell you why these kids may potentially have a hepatocellular carcinoma. And really, for the most part, the way you treat this, you give a diet low in tyrosine, because again, if tyrosine builds, the more tyrosine you give, the more you increase flux through that tyrosine breakdown pathway, and then succinyl acetone will build up. But other things you want to do, right? There's this drug known as nitisinone, so NITISI, and then none, right? So nitisinone. Basically, it inhibits, it's a drug that it's very expensive. The thing is, it inhibits an enzyme that, so maybe let's think of it this way. Let's say there are six steps in the breakdown of tyrosine, right? And let's say that the step that, leads to the formation of succinyl acetone is like step five. The thing is, you can give this drug nitisinone, it inhibits like a drug in step two of the breakdown. So you don't even build up the succinyl acetone in the first place, okay? So that's why nitisinone works extremely well with this disorder. The only problem is when you give a person a nitisinone, you actually have to monitor their levels of phenylalanine and tyrosine, kind of make sure it doesn't build up to like toxic levels. Because the thing is, by inhibiting this enzyme, I mean, if you're interested, again, I think that knowing the enzyme name is very loyal for exams, but the enzyme name is like hydroxyl phenyl pyruvate dioxygenase. But basically, if you inhibit the enzyme, your phenylalanine and tyrosine actually go up, right? And you don't want to like essentially induce PKU in a kid, right? So you want to measure, monitor their levels of tyrosine and phenylalanine when they're on a nitisinone. So that's, again, classic presentation of the type 1 tyrosinemia. Kid from Canada, urine smells like cabbage, hepatocellular carcinoma in a kid, type 2 RTA, Fanconi syndrome-like presentation, liver problems, okay? That's the classic presentation of type 1 tyrosinemia. And then, what if they give you a question about a kid that, seems to have, they tell you that, man, during the third trimester, this kid was observed to have multiple hiccups. Mom says she has like unusual fetal movement in the third trimester. And they tell you that, after this kid is born, this kid keeps having like recurrent seizures, having like apneic episodes, and this kid just, needs to be intubated. And then this kid is severely encephalopathic. Has like all these movement problems, intellectual disability, just respiratory issues that require intubation. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would hope you're telling me that you're thinking about something called glycine encephalopathy. Okay, glycine encephalopathy. Sometimes it's called a non-ketotic hyperglycemia. Okay, not hyperglycemia. Okay, because the thing is on exams, right? Again, this is how can you make an exam hard, right? Just put words that sound similar, right? So look out for the term, right? Don't choose non-ketotic hyperglycemia. This is non-ketotic hyperglycemia, right? So elevated levels of glycine. And actually, this glycine encephalopathy, believe it or not, it's actually the second most common amino acid and metabolic disorder after PKU, right? So the thing is, the deficient, the mutation that people have here is they have a defect in like an enzyme complex known as the glycine cleavage system. The glycine cleavage system is basically like a system of enzymes. It has like four subunits, if I'm not mistaken, that breaks down glycine, right? So if you have a mutation in the glycine cleavage system, you won't be able to break down glycine. So glycine will build up to like very toxic levels in like body fluids, in the CSF. The big one I want you to remember is that the glycine builds up to toxic levels in the CSF, okay? And again, you just want to be careful. Notice I specifically called this non-ketotic hyperglycinemia. The reason I called it a non-ketotic hyperglycinemia is because there are actually some other disorders that I'll talk about probably in a follow-up podcast that are associated with like a ketotic hyperglycinemia, right? So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And the diagnostic test, right? You know, you check levels of glycine in the CSF. You'll be you check levels of glycine in the CSF and in the plasma. The levels, like you almost measure it as a ratio. The ratio of glycine in the CSF will be much higher than the glycine in the plasma. That tells you that, okay, this person has this glycine encephalopathy. Remember I just said that, that people can have a ketotic hyperglycinemia. The thing is, in ketotic hyperglycinemia, people may have elevated levels of glycine, but the thing is, the ratio between like the CSF glycine and the plasma glycine will be like relatively normal. And really, for the most part, the way you treat this glycine encephalopathy is you can essentially, give the kids like sodium benzoate. The sodium benzoate will bind up glycine and convert it to heparate. And then that can be safely excreted. And then you can also give dextromethorphan. Although, to be honest, like this disease is not really well understood. But for the most part, people think that glycine acting on NMD receptors causes many of the like neurological symptoms that these kids have. So if you give dextromethorphan is like an NMD receptor antagonist. So that can help with like preventing glycine from binding and can hopefully help under those circumstances. And with this disease, I mean, it's terrible, right? Most times, like by the age of 3, like 90 days of life, most of the boys with this disorder are dead. Girls, their life expectancy is even worse. They're usually dead within like the first 30 days of life. So, it's a pretty terrible disorder, but thankfully it's pretty rare. But I mean, it's not something you would wish on anyone. Now, I think the last group of disorders I'll probably talk about in this podcast, because again, I want to really keep this under like 40 minutes if I can, is the urea cycle defects, right? So if you're a peds resident, I mean, probably from step one, probably the only urea cycle thing you remember is like, if you remember any at all, is OTC deficiency, like ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. Unfortunately, that's not enough for the peds boards. For the peds boards, they do actually want you to know the different urea cycle defects. Is about 9 of them. The thing I would encourage you to focus on, because again, many of these disorders, the presentation is the same, right? Although some of them have like some unique things, but I will tell you that the thing that will be the clincher on your exam that will help you get the correct answer is knowing what is up and what is down. Like almost all these disorders have like something that is uniquely elevated and uniquely decreased. If you can keep those things at the back of your mind, then you should be golden for these urea cycle disorders. But for the most part, right, for the urea cycle disorders, the classic presentation is, they'll give you a kid that, within the first few days of life is fine. But once this kid starts like feeding, like getting food of any sort, this kid, has very poor arousal. Like they'll tell you that the parents try to wake this kid up to feed, but this kid is not very responsive, right? And this kid may have hyperventilation, so they can have a respiratory alkalosis, because again, ammonia is kind of toxic to the brain. These kids tend to be hypothermic. Remember, the way I kind of think about it is, if you remember from med school, taking care of a person that has liver disease, people with liver problems like cirrhosis, they tend to be hypothermic, right? And the urea cycle operates in the liver, right? So that may give you some hints as to why these people may be hypothermic, although that's not really the reason. It's more related to the ammonia toxic effects in the brain. And then typically, right, you do a newborn screen, you notice that these people have very high levels of ammonia. So they have a hyperammonemia. Their glutamine is also elevated, because glutamine is one of the feedstocks for the urea cycle. And again, classically, these kids tend to have a respiratory alkalosis, right? And really, for the most part, the way you detect these, again, like I said, you do a newborn screen, You check ammonia levels, you check glutamine levels, you check levels of like citrulline, you check levels of arginine, you check like levels of like orotic acid in the urine. Because the thing is, different permutations of what is elevated or decreased will tell you that, oh, you're dealing with one disorder versus the other. So, and you may say, like, Divine, why does this ammonia cause any problems? I mean, it's just ammonia. Well, it's not just, well, I mean, it's just ammonia, but the problem is ammonia, right, crosses the blood-brain barrier pretty easily, right? And when it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it loves to settle in astrocytes, right? And the thing is, when the ammonia settles in astrocytes, ammonia is very reactive. And I mean, it's very osmotic, right? So it draws a lot of water into those astrocytes. So those astrocytes swell. And as the astrocytes swell, that can actually begin to cause, like, increase the intracranial pressures. Believe it or not, there are actually, like, cases of kids that have had, like, a brain herniation and died from this disorder, right? So those increased intracranial pressures, remember, right, those increased intracranial pressures, the brain will try to say, oh, crap, my intracranial pressures are high. Let me try to, like, lower my ICP by hyperventilating, right? I mean, if you've taken care of anyone in the hospital with like elevated ICP from like an ischemic stroke or whatever, you raise that person's respiratory rate while they're on the vent, right? So the thing is, many times when people have these problems, right, the astrocytes swell, that causes increased ICP, they begin to hyperventilate. It's that hyperventilation that ultimately causes the respiratory alkalosis, right? So those are, again, classic presentations. Kid, you know, first few days of life, kid is not very arousable to feed, has hyperventilation. And again, I've explained the mechanism behind that, has hypothermia. Their blood pH will be very high, so it'll be more than like 7.45 because they have... they have like the respiratory alkalosis, right? Or they may give you like ABGs and you see like a profoundly depressed PCO2. If you see that, again, you want to think about some kind of a urea cycle or problem. And again, I've talked about the different labs that you check. And some key things you want to keep in mind is, I guess in terms of treatment, right? For treatment, you can actually give something called a phenylbutyrate, right? So you give phenylbutyrate. The thing is, it essentially binds ammonia, right? It can bind ammonia, it can bind glutamine, and then you can pee it out, right? And then the thing is, you also tend to want to supplement like arginine and citrulline in the diet, because by giving arginine and citrulline, you kind of make the urea cycle work better. Because the thing is, arginine and citrulline, the body taps them from other pathways to use in the urea cycle. So typically for these kids, you know, you tend to supplement like arginine and citrulline. And then you also, you know, if a person has like, you know, very severely elevated ammonia levels, obviously you go ahead and do dialysis under those circumstances. And then also for these kids, you also want to, you know, to increase their caloric intake. Because think about it, right? If you have a urea cycle problem, you have issues metabolizing a protein, right? Metabolizing ammonia and all that stuff. So the thing is, you essentially want to decrease the instances where these kids would need their urea cycles to work. Right, so for these kids, you want to give them like, you know, very rich carbohydrate diet, because if they're essentially not in a fasting state, then they will essentially never break down muscle, right? And maybe like, you know, participating in marathons may not be the smartest idea for these kids, because again, right, you break down muscle and then you need your urea cycle under those circumstances. And then obviously you also want to restrict protein in these kids' diets. So what are the big ones, right? So I think the first two, I'll just kind of discuss them together. Like the first one is like CPS1 deficiency, so like a carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1 deficiency. And then the second one is like NAGS deficiency. People call it like N-acetylglutamate deficiency. Really, for the most part, the symptoms are, again, are urea cycle symptoms, which I, again, I've already talked about. In CPS1 deficiency, these people, they have a deficiency of a carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1, right? And because they have that, again, they'll have hyperammonemia, so their ammonia levels will be elevated, but every other thing will be low. They'll have like low levels of orotic acid, because the thing is, orotic acid is made from carbamoyl phosphate. So if you have a deficiency of CPS1, you're not going to be able to make carbamoyl phosphate. If you can't make carbamoyl phosphate, your orotic acid will be low, right? So these people tend to have like, you know, like hyperammonemia, but every other thing is low orotic acid, low citrulline, low arginine. Again, it's what is high, what is low, that will tell you what urea cycle or defect you're dealing with for the most part on exams. So that's, again, a very high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. So that's really what obtains in CPS1 deficiency. NAGS deficiency is like literally the same thing, like N-acetylglutamate synthetase deficiency. The thing is, if you look at the urea cycle, right, so CPS1 is kind of like the rate limiting enzyme of the urea cycle. Maybe not not so, I think it's OTC, but actually, I take that back. I'm almost certain CPS1 is the, but again, that's not necessary for the PEDS boards, different audience here. But CPS1 is the first enzyme of the urea cycle, right? The thing is, CPS1 uses N-acetylglutamate as a cofactor, right? So the thing is, N-acetylglutamate is made by an enzyme known as N-acetylglutamate synthetase. So if you have a deficiency of N-acetylglutamate synthetase, so like NAGS, many people call it like NAGS deficiency, then you can't produce N-acetylglutamate, then CPS1 doesn't work, right? And then you're in trouble, right? And again, the presentation of these things are exactly the same, right? Like they'll have like elevated ammonia, but low citrulline, low orotic acid, low arginine. So you may say, okay, divine, how do I differentiate between these two things? Well, two things you can use, right? So one is you do like DNA testing, right? Because people with NAGS deficiency, they tend to have like issues with like the long arm of chromosome 17. People with CPS1 deficiency, basically you'll observe different gene defects causing those two disorders. And then one other classic thing that shows up on exams with NAGS deficiency, you can actually treat it with a drug known as carglumic acid. The thing is, carglumic acid is like a structural analog of N-acetylglutamate. So by giving N-acetylglutamate, you're essentially giving what they're missing. You're saying, you know what, I'm not going to use NAGS anymore. I'll just give you the cofactor. So it tends to help somewhat in this disorder. Although again, carglumic acid is extremely expensive. So that's what I will say about the first two. The next one, right, is like OTC deficiency. This one will classically show up in a boy on exams. Remember, OTC was one of those, it was the O in the Halo M mnemonic I talked about earlier. So it will likely show up in a guy on tests. Although the thing is, female carriers, because that have this disease, they can also get like some symptoms, especially when they're like very sick, like when they're like septic or whatever. So, but for the most part, like maybe like 99% of the people you see with OTC deficiency on your PEDS boards, they'll be guys, right? And again, they'll have hyperammonemia, but here's a key difference. They'll also have elevated levels of orotic acid, right? Because OTC, ornithine transcarbamylase, converts like carbamyl phosphates to like other stuff, right? So the thing is, if OTC is deficient, right, then you'll be able to convert carbamyl phosphates to other stuff. So carbamyl phosphate will build up, and then it will leave the mitochondria, go into the cytosol, and then it will be made into orotic acid. So if you see a person that has a urea cycle defect, and they have elevated levels of ammonia and orotic acid, but every other thing is low, like low arginine, low arginine, low citrulline, think about an OTC deficiency. And again, the presentation is exactly like what I've talked about for like the general classic presentation of urea cycle disorders. And then the next one I'll talk about is like a type 1 citrullinemia. Right, so type 1 citrullinemia. The reason I'm saying type 1 is, if there is a type 1 citrullinemia, then you should also stand to reason that there is such a thing as a type 2 citrullinemia, right? So a type 1 citrullinemia, it's a deficiency in an enzyme known as arginosuccinate synthetase. There's a mnemonic people use for this. It's kind of like risque, but like ass, like a person's ass, like ASS, like ass deficiency. So when you have a deficiency of ass, then you can have like this urea cycle problem called a type 1 citrullinemia. Again, the big thing you want to remember here is what builds, because the thing is, it's like, think of the urea cycle symptoms as a script, like the lethargy, poor arousal, and everything. They'll give you all the same presentation for all of them. But again, they'll give you labs, and then that's what clinches the diagnosis, right? So people that have the type 1 citrullinemia, they have elevated levels of ammonia, and they have elevated levels of citrulline, right? Because they'll have the elevated levels of citrulline because, again, arginosuccinate synthetase, right? AS for short. Kind of funny saying that, but anyhow. When AS doesn't work as well as it should, right, then citrulline will build up, right? But these people have low levels of arginine. So remember, I said in OTC deficiency, you have hyperammonemia, you have elevated levels of orotic acid, but the arginine and citrulline are low. And then I said in CPS1 and NAGS deficiency, you have hyperammonemia, but every other thing is low. Orotic acid, arginine, citrulline, all low, right? But now I'm saying in type 1 citrullinemia, you have like elevated levels of ammonia, so you have hyperammonemia, but you also have elevated levels of citrulline, right? the arginine levels are low. Okay, so again, you see that there are all different permutations of all these things. The next big one, and one thing I will say about type 1 citrullinemia that may help you on exams is the symptoms tend to start in childhood. Right? Contrast this with type 2 citrullinemia that I'll talk about in a bit, where the symptoms tend to start in adulthood. In fact, I think, you know, maybe it may make sense to talk about type 2 citrullinemia like right now. I mean, like the type 2 citrullinemia, for the most part, starts in adulthood. It arises from like a deficiency in an enzyme known as citrine. Right? And again, for the most part, it will present with like liver problems in adults. Rarely can show up in kids as like a neonatal hepatitis, but really for the most part, think of type 1 citrullinemia as a kid problem, right? And then think of type 2 citrullinemia as an adult problem. And a nice way to remember which is, I just tell myself that you gotta be a kid first, so that's type 1, before you become an adult, that's type 2, okay? So that's a nice way to sort of keep those things straight in your mind. Then the next uropsychiatric disorder I'll talk about is this disorder known as arginino-succinate aciduria. Okay, so arginino-succinate aciduria. The big thing that you want to keep in mind here, is that these people, they will have elevated levels of ammonia, they will have elevated levels of citrulline, they will have low levels of arginine. So you may say, Divine, come on, how am I going to differentiate this from like the type 1 citrullinemia? Because those are exactly the same labs in type 1 citrullinemia, like high ammonia, high citrulline, low arginine. Here's the kicker. People that have arginino-succinate aciduria, they have high levels of arginino-succinate. So if you see elevated levels of arginino-succinate, then your diagnosis on your PEDS board should be arginino-succinate aciduria. And really, the enzyme that's deficient here is our arginino-succinate lyase. That's like the classic enzyme that's deficient. The thing is, this disorder presents just like any urea cycle defect. But here is one classic thing that may help you, like tell you that, oh yeah, this is what I'm dealing with on the test. They can show you like a picture of like a person's hair, and the hair will have like these like broken shafts, and you'll have like these like little nodules. I'll encourage you to look up a picture of it. I think it's called trichorexis nodosa. So not polyarthritis nodosa, not erythema nodosa. Trichorexis nodosa. It's like a particular hair problem. Just look up a picture of this online. That's like classic presentation with arginino-succinate aciduria. The mechanism behind those hair findings, remember, you kind of need like appropriate protein function because your hair uses a lot of protein. But I'm not going to say any more than that because, again, that's not something that's relevant for your exam. And the next one I'll talk about is, I promise this will be over soon. I'll soon put you out of your pain. The next one is arginemia, right? So arginemia, right? This one is easy. It's a deficiency of the enzyme arginase. One key thing actually you want to keep at the back of your mind here is in this disorder, this is the only disorder, at least urocycle disorder that you'll see on your exams, that has an elevation in arginine. Okay, remember every other thing has had like low arginine. And I will summarize like which is high, which is low at the end, just to again sort of put everything together for you. But in arginemia, these people have like high arginine, but for the most part, the ammonia tends to be normal. Yeah, it could be elevated in some people, but that's extremely rare. For the most part, the ammonia tends to be normal, right? The big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind here is it's an arginase deficiency, and these people tend to have like prominent muscle findings, right? So they'll have like a spastic like quadriplegia, so like they'll be paralyzed in their upper and lower extremities. And the thing is, it's progressive. So let's say they may have, you know, like one small muscle group that's affected at birth, but as they keep progressing through life, more and more muscles get affected until they get like a spastic quadriplegia. Contrast this with cerebral palsy, right? That's like more like, you know, cerebral palsy by definition doesn't progress, right? It's kind of like static. So that's one way to differentiate those two on tests. And again, they'll usually give you labs on exams. And then one of the last two disorders I want to talk about, there's this urocycle defect called like triple H syndrome. It's like hyperornithemia, hyperammonemia, homocitrullinemia syndrome. Just remember it as triple H syndrome. I wish other people use the other name. It's like sometimes it's called like an ornithine translocase deficiency. Basically, Ornithine translocase. Translocase means it transports things, right? So it moves like ornithine to the mitochondria so that it can participate in the urea cycle. So the thing is, if you have a mutation in this mitochondrial transporter, you won't be able to move anything into the mitochondria for the urea cycle. So you have urea cycle style problems. These people, the big things you want to keep in mind is they'll have elevated levels of ammonia, and they'll have like elevated levels of ornithine, and they'll have elevated levels of homocitrulline. If you see that, your diagnosis is done. It's a triple H syndrome. And then the last one I'll talk about is this thing called LPI syndrome. It's like a lysinuric protein intolerance. Basically, it's a problem with a transporter that you find at the proximal convoluted tubule and in the small intestine. So the thing is, the classic presentation, and pay attention here, right? They'll describe a kid that, you know, was been fine, you know, for the first like 6 months of life. And this, let's say the kid was exclusively breastfed for that period. And then they tell you that, oh, you know, this kid was recently weaned from breastfeeding. And then they notice that, man, as this kid was weaned from breastfeeding, this kid started having like a lot of vomiting, diarrhea, hepatosplenomegaly, like osteoporosis, like pulmonary problems, like interstitial pneumonias, glomerulonephritis, right? So like hematuria. It's almost like a post-infectious glomerulonephritis, a picture. Or they have like recurrent infections, or they have like osteoporosis. If you see all those things, you really want to think about LPI, right? So again, lysinuric protein intolerance. It's a problem with, like, again, like I said, a transporter. So you have issues like reabsorbing like ornithine, lysine, and arginine. The way I just remember like what's going on here is, if any of you are from like New Orleans, right? So like NOLA, just remove the N. So just remember OLA, so like an OLA, like transporter defect. These people will not be able to reabsorb ornithine, lysine, and arginine in the urine, right? So obviously, if you're doing diagnostic testing, they'll have like very high levels of ornithine, lysine, and arginine in the urine. Because remember, ornithine and arginine are required, right, for the urea cycle to work well. So if you're not reabsorbing these things, your urea cycle won't work so well. So you have like signs and symptoms of urea cycle issues. And again, for the most part, you will treat this with citrulline. Again, by giving citrulline, you know, you kind of like spruce up the urea cycle, and it begins to work a little better. But again, it's not like perfect treatment or anything like that. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer tutoring for many exams, right? So if you have any friends or buddies or colleagues or siblings that need tutoring for step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams, or you know medicine residents that need tutoring for the medicine in training exam, the medicine boards, or you have a peds resident that needs tutoring for the pediatric boards, I do offer tutoring for all those things. I have these booster courses I offer for the USMLE exams. It's like a 20-hour booster course for step 1. It's a 10-hour booster course for step 2, CK, and step 3. Essentially, in those booster courses, typically something you do like in the last week of your prep or when you feel like your knowledge base is pretty good, I use a very short period of time and I integrate like most of the high-yield things that are tested on the exam in a Q&A format. We sort of walk through those. And then I also offer like longitudinal tutoring where if you're like a first or second year med student or your third year med student, I tutor you for like your block exams or your shelf exams. And then at the same time, I tutor you for your like upcoming USMLE exam. And by doing that, everyone I've done that with has been like wildly successful on tests because it's like by the time they hit the dedicated periods, they tend to be like super, super ready for the exams. And then if you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for like general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochemistry, histology, physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things as well. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer, I guess, like one-on-one, like advising or coaching, or I guess you can call it consulting for those. So things like personal statements, rec letters, editing applications, mock interviews. I mean, I've worked with tons and tons of students that have applied for both of these things. And I've also been on an admissions committee at a top 2 med school for like a year. So I have, again, a ton of experience with these issues. So if you need any help with any of those things, either reach out to me through the website or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So I wish you a wonderful weekend. Have a great rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.